So one day I got home from work at night, and everything I owned was in a cardboard box, and it would turn into an end table for, you know, whatever bedroom I had. I would flip it upside down, and I would put my alarm clock and a little lamp, my little boom box of tapes or books on it or whatever. Well, that box was in the front yard when I got home with all my stuff in it. So I hid it in the woods, and you know, I had only been in town for a few months. I only knew one person. This was pre-cell phone days. And I went to his house. His name was Mark. I threw some pebbles at his bedroom window on the second floor, hoping the heck that he was home. I said, "Hey, man, you know, can I crash here just for the night? I got to figure things out tomorrow." And he asked his parents, and they said yes. And tomorrow turned into a week, and a week turned into a couple weeks. They ultimately offered a room to me for rent.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Shane, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thanks so much for having me. We've been looking forward to this for probably 5 years. I've been a big
fan. Well, yeah. So you have been a longtime listener, and I think it's something that I absolutely love when one of our listeners sends me a story that makes me think, oh yeah, this person should be a guest. And I remember reading your pitch and thinking, holy shit, this is crazy. There are so many layers to this, all of which we will get into. But having just read your new book, I want to start with what I think is a very relevant question. And that is, where in the world did you grow up? And how did that end up impacting the way your life and your career has turned out?
Okay. Yeah. So I mostly grew up in Western Massachusetts. I moved around a lot. My mother was a single mom, but then she was married and then a single mom again. She had several marriages. So we were, we were moving every year, every 6 months. I went to lots of elementary schools, lots of middle schools. So, you know, moving around that often, it teaches you a few things. And first is, you know, how to read people. When you're the new kid in class, every 6 months, you don't have time to waste, you know what I mean? So I think you learn how to read people, who's in my tribe and who's not, probably mm-hmm. quicker than you would otherwise.
Yeah. Yeah. So one thing I wonder, you know, you mentioned your mom being a single mom, married and not, what has been the impact of the instability of father figures in your life, and how has that influenced your own role as a father?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I became homeless at 14 and a half. And then briefly I was back with my mother for a few months and then homeless again. And then I was legally emancipated around 15 and a half or so, which means that I'm my own guardian, essentially. I'm a minor, but I'm emancipated. So while I didn't have father figures, I mean, my own father was British. I actually just met him for the first time a couple of years ago. So I have kind of a relationship with him now that I never had in my entire life. But I had a lot of friends, and wherever I was, you know, I had friends and I knew, you know, their parents, their fathers, and then honestly, as a kid, as a teenager, you know, I was kind of a bookworm, you know, and I really got into lots of different authors. And although they weren't my father figure, I read everything about them. I researched them. I wanted to be like them. Even like Stephen King would have been in that crowd, you know, as a teenager. So yeah, not having a father, I'm not sure that it impacted me in a significant way necessarily, because I found other figures, other mentors, other people to emulate as a kid. I never really felt like I was without something. I never felt at a loss for whatever reason.
What prompted the emancipation. It's funny because I, you know, the only time I've ever heard about this is just on TV when I see it in various like teeny bopper TV shows and stuff. What prompted that, and how did that end up shaping the relationship you have with your mother?
Yeah. So, I mean, I have a relationship with my mother today. And she's obviously she's older now. She had a tough time with her kids, and I had lots of I had step siblings, I had half siblings, I had a half sibling that died, I had one that was given up for adoption. The situation was that she just wasn't capable of being a mother at that time. So all of my older half siblings left before they were 16 or 17 years old. They went and moved away with their father's family. But for me, that wasn't an option because I didn't know who my father was and I didn't know where he lived. So, it was at the time, it probably couldn't be replicated anymore. I mean, the scenario today probably wouldn't exist. I probably would have been put in, some sort of foster care under, the auspices of the state or something. But at that time, I just feel like it was a lot easier to fall through the cracks. So, I ended up finding an apartment ultimately by the time I was 16 years old and I was in my fourth high school. I did three high schools in a year and a half. But I finally found some stability. I started working full time while I was in high school. High school certainly wasn't the priority. My goal was to just get out of there because I had, survival to think about. But I never saw my mother for a long time, for years, from probably 16 to 22, maybe 23. I went quite the stretch. There's a theme in the Rocket Crew book about how people can change and how we have to have patience with people. And we're not all designed like each other, as much as we would think that we are, and as much as we have in common, people are very different. And, with my mother, I've gotten to know her better as an adult and as an older adult now. And while there are certainly things that I can't forgive, I've come to a place, though, where I can appreciate her situation. I don't have to like it, but as an adult now, and as she's an older person, I can understand some of the challenges that she was going through at that time.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it makes me think that, so many of us overlook context when we hear things from certain people. Like I used to battle my parents on this, like, the advice that they would give me about careers when I was growing up. And it took me a long time to come to terms with the fact that, wait a minute, you're giving me advice based on a very different context. You grew up in a circumstance in which your life outcomes were binary. It was poverty or security. Right. So of course, you're not going to encourage me to pursue something that is, uncertain. Right. And I think that we tend to really overlook that.
Right.
So what I wonder also, I don't want to come back to your father, but how did this end up impacting the relationships that you have with other people in your life? Like significant others, your children, your friends, having had this experience with parents, because I think this is no secret that parents play a pivotal role in our development.
Yeah, I think for me, and not to sound like overly dramatic or cliche, but, as a teenager, in that situation, when you're living in, sleeping in laundromats and you're worrying about your safety, or you're hungry all the time and you're worried about tomorrow and the next day and the next day, I think one thing for sure, was that I really appreciated my friendships. Like for me, friends as, were like gold. I never took them for granted, and I think that's true today. And it's been true you know, in all of my various careers, whether I was at the White House, whether I was in corporate America or the military, or in my own writing world, this, you know, this idea of really nurturing relationships and really appreciating those relationships and never taking them for granted. I think for me, that was a fuel as a teenager, you know, that got me through the day. And it sounds a little cliche again, but like it really did. Like, you know, having those really strong bonds, that it's like an elixir for bad times, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Tell me about the very first night you were homeless.
Yeah. So, okay. I don't know if it was the first night, because what happened was it started sprinkling in from the time I was maybe 13, and, you know, you get kicked out and then I'd come back, and, you know, you're too little, right? So you have to keep coming back. But I think one of the first experiences I can recall in its entirety is, you know, there was, you know, a big fight. There was a lot of violence, a lot of fighting, wherever we lived. And, you know, with my mother and her husband or boyfriend or whatever. And I was usually the referee. I was, you know, for me as a kid, I always felt like I heard things louder, saw things clearer. I don't know if that was true or not, but, you know, so I really had a low tolerance for violence. And so I would inevitably try to break things up, as best as I could, you know, as a kid, especially 13 or 14, that's pretty tough. But one night, you know, things were rougher than normal, and, you know, I got kicked out, but it was, you know, the winter time and I was in shorts and it was cold. And, you know, I think that was one of the first times I realized that, you know, this isn't something that I can keep doing. You know, it's not normal, and it's just, you know, it's cruel, and it's just not right. And so that particular night, I literally called my best friend who lived in town, and, you know, I stayed over there. But I ended up going back, because at that time, you know, this is the mid-80s, early 80s, you know, you didn't have the safety nets that you have today. You didn't have the social constructs, the ecosystem, you know, that exists today, to help kids out. So it wasn't until I was about 15 and a half where I got kicked out for the last time and didn't come back, you know, and really had to look forward into figuring things out on my own. And so originally I moved in with my older half sister, but that only lasted a couple months because she was moving herself and she had a baby and just wasn't in a position of taking care of her much younger half brother. After that, I couch surfed for a whole summer. I was 15, different friends' houses. And at the start of what should have been my junior year in high school, I ended up in a little college town where I rented a room with an older woman. But that only lasted a few months because she had early onset Alzheimer's. So she, you know, she eventually just became very unhealthy and I couldn't stay there. So one day I got home from work at night, and everything I owned was in a cardboard box. And that cardboard box I would move around with me all the time. And it would turn into an end table for, you know, whatever bedroom I had. I would flip it upside down and I would put my alarm clock and a little lamp, my little boom box of tapes or books on it or whatever. Well, that box was in the front yard when I got home with all my stuff in it. So I hid it in the woods, and, you know, I had only been in town for a few months. I only knew one person. This was pre-cell phone days. And I went to his house. His name was Mark. And I threw some pebbles at his bedroom window on the second floor, hoping the heck that he was home. And he was. And said, hey, man, you know, can I crash here just for the night? I got to figure things out tomorrow. And he asked his parents and they said yes. And tomorrow turned into a week and a week turned into a couple weeks. And I was getting nowhere fast because I didn't have any resources or connections. And they ultimately offered a room to me for rent. And so I ended up staying at that house and I rented a small room. I paid room and board. So they weren't like parents, but they were really, really nice people. They were very generous, very patient, very tolerant for a kid with a huge chip on his shoulder.
Hmm. Wow. The other question I want to ask, and then I want to start digging deeper into this and kind of where it goes from here, is about that meeting with your father. What is that moment like to go and see somebody that you know deep down wasn't there?
Yeah.
You know, that should have been, that you see the messages from society all around you. Probably, I'm sure, saw friends whose fathers were role models in the way that you hoped a father would be. So what was that like the first time you met him?
Yeah, it was just a couple of years ago. It was a little surreal, but, you know, without even talking to him, I understood why he wasn't there. I mean, because I understood the environment that he was in. You know, what I couldn't appreciate is how you could abandon your child, right? There's a difference between leaving a situation but still having a connection, you know, with your child. That part I couldn't understand, but I really didn't need an explanation as to why he left. I probably would have left too. You know, it was a tough environment to be in. But again, you know, I'm a big believer in really not judging people based on, you know, first glance observations, right? Like, you have to hear people's story. Yeah. You know, for him, you know, he apologized. He didn't really have anything to offer in terms of, you know, the way he severed, you know, connections. It was kind of strange, though, as a kid, because I knew who he was because I would always get, it was odd, I would always get a birthday card wherever I was. Same handwriting, you know, and when I moved, I would send my new address, you know, back to him. So yeah, it was a little surreal. And I, you know, we sat down and I think if I had met him 10 years before or 20 or 30, mm-hmm. that initial experience would have been very different. I probably still would have had some pent up, you know, anger or whatever, but really it's not very productive, you know, I was almost 50 years old, you know, my late 40s, you know, coming into that scenario with an old man in his late 70s, bringing in all this anger and animosity, really, I mean, what would have been the point? You know, yeah. I mean, he's a very kind, you know, older gentleman now. He's British. You know, he's got a whole new family. He loves his daughter, my half-sister. You know, and I'm glad. I'm actually kind of glad that I waited until my 40s before we could connect. Because I think I have a lot more patience now that I probably would not have had in my 20s or 30s.
You know, it's funny. That reminds me of a conversation I was once having with my sister. You know, like my mom and I've had a complicated relationship and, you know, she's definitely pushed my buttons and, you know, we've said things to each other. And my sister once said, what are you going to do on her deathbed? Tell her all the things you thought were horrible. She's like, do you know how awful that would be to do to somebody? And I never, when she put it that way, I realized, I was like, yeah, what would be the point? Right. Like you said.
Yeah. I mean, with my father, you know, we have a very topical relationship. I really don't know him that well. I've seen him actually twice now. We've talked a few times on the phone. You know, he's very pleasant, but you know, I you know, he's my father. I wouldn't call him dad, right?
Yeah. There's
a difference. You know, he's very pleasant and I'm glad that I have a relationship with him. I'm glad I got to know him. He's kind of a wild child in an 80-year-old body today. I think if I had met him earlier in life, the experience would have been much, much different. So, yeah.
So, you know, One thing I wonder, when I hear you tell this story, you know, one of the things that we as Indian Americans or Indians often know is that no matter the circumstances of our lives, like our parents' door is always open. You know, like I remember when my best friend, his parents didn't come to his wedding. I was just like, dude, no matter what kind of fight I had with my parents, like that would never happen in my life. And he's, you know, and it's funny, he was a guest recently. You probably heard my conversation with Gareth.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I remember he came to my 42nd birthday at my parents' house, and he said, you know what? He said, it's amazing that you still have this relationship with your parents. And he's like, you know, crushing it and making all this money. And yet he's like, but you have this, you know, it's like this grass is always greener on the other side thing. But what I wonder from your experience is, you know, you seem to have developed what, you know, appears to me from just hearing your story, a tremendous amount of resilience and self-reliance. So what I wonder is, you know, coming from the environment that you did, a lot of people become victims of that environment. You seem to have overcome it. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, that's a great question. It really is. I think there are a couple things at play. First, honestly, I was scared to death. Okay, so I ran with the wild ones for sure, right? And basically did everything that they did. But I was usually the kid in the back going, hey guys, is this a good idea? I'm not really sure this is a great idea, but we're going to do it anyway. But honestly, I was very fearful of screwing up really bad or, you know, injuring myself because I was worried that, you know, nobody was coming to get me, right? So where most of my friends had at least one parent that, you know, would be there. Right? They had some kind of safety net. But when you don't have a safety net, when one doesn't exist, you know, it's a very different situation. When you know there is no safety net, you know, you can't help but be a little paranoid. And you know, so I feel like fear was one of the reasons. The second reason was honestly stubbornness. You know, I've spent over a decade in talent development, working with young people, middle-aged people, and older people become the best versions of themselves. And, you know, one of the things that fuels my passion for that kind of work is, you know, when I think about the billions of people on this earth, right, and the hundreds and hundreds of millions, if not billions, of people who don't have opportunities and are in situations out of their control, especially kids. You know, they don't have resources. They don't have any structure. They don't have the right education, the right pedigree, the right, you know, money, anything. I think about the stories that will never be written. I think about the poems that will never be written. I think about inventions that will never be invented, businesses, leaders that will never see. I mean, it is a damn crime. And it's one thing that I've learned, you know, as a kid in that situation, being surrounded by lots of others who really didn't have safety nets, who lacked resources, structure, you know, their creativity, their innovation, their view will never be seen, will never be heard. You know, I mean, the odds are stacked against them. So for me as a kid in that situation, not that I would articulate it this way then, I was stubborn and I was going to be damned if I was going to let somebody size me up and make a final impression of me based on who they thought I was, you know? And so I always tried to never let my circumstances, the things that were happening right in front of me, at that moment, dictate the long view for me. Mm. And it was more of a stubbornness. I didn't have any sort of philosophical bent to it. I could, you know, it was just like, you know, how dare you size me up because of the kind of clothes that I'm wearing or the haircut that I have, or, you know, my funny vocabulary at the time. How dare you size me up? So, you know, I was snubbing, you know, the adult world around me and daring them to take a closer look because, you know, you really can't judge a book by its cover. And that stubbornness you know, combined with a little bit of fear. And to be quite honest, hope, you know, like having this sort of blind hope. I know that doesn't sound very scientific, but having a real, genuine, robust sense of hope and that things will get better. I think those three things were really what got me through that time, and didn't just get me through in terms of survival, but really created, you know, kind of a framework that I could be successful and not just survive. There's a difference, right? And eventually seeing success. And to be quite honest, you know, living without any structure, you know, not having to answer to anybody, it also allows you to be pretty damn innovative and pretty creative, right? You're not...
I can relate.
Yeah, you're not risk adverse, right? You're not... You have nothing... When you have nothing, you've got nothing to lose, right? So, you know, I mean, as a teenager, I did every job, and I was modeling. I was doing demolition, construction, pizza delivery, dishwasher. I was perfectly terrible at most of those jobs. what I mean is, when you don't have that kind of structure or expectations, it really allows you to invent yourself, reinvent yourself, and create your own persona, because you're not, you know, you're not bound by anybody's expectations of who you should be.
Yeah. Wow. So walk me through how this leads to the White House, the military, and then we'll actually talk about Rocket Crew. You know, I'll tie it together in some weird twisted way. But talk to me of how you get to the White House and the military and what you did there.
Okay, so after high school, so I ended up staying back a year because the three high schools in a year and a half, I had major credit transfer problems. So I repeated my sophomore year. So I spent 5 years in high school. After I graduated, I went to a community college. I actually got scholarship, and I actually got an award, a graduation award in high school for most improved academically. So, and that came, I think it came with a $500 check. So I went to community college, but I was still working my butt off because while, you know, I had some grants and I had some scholarships and things like that, I still had to pay for books and rent and food and insurance and all that other stuff. So I was starting to burn out. I felt like I was in like a midlife crisis at 18, you know, 19 years old. So I didn't have health insurance. I didn't have dental insurance. So yeah, you can get grants and scholarships to go to college, but it doesn't pay for your insurance. And I had some health issues at that point, because at that point, by the time I was 18 and 19, I was lifting weights. I was doing kickboxing, and I had some injuries, and they were lasting a lot longer than they should have. So I ended up biting the bullet, and I went into the Air Force Reserve. And so that created a whole different world. Now, for the first time, I'm getting yelled at by people who don't know me. I'm supposed to do exactly what I'm told and when. And, you know, I felt like I was 40 years old in basic training when I was only 21. It was a little odd. But, you know, what I found was I didn't know much about the military. But what I found was, you know, that institution was, you know, very, very welcoming to somebody like me. They had no preconceived ideas. You know, when you're coming into that environment, everyone's wearing the same uniform. Everyone has the same haircut. You know what I mean? Like, there's no, you know, it's not like corporate America where you can look at someone's LinkedIn and see, oh, they went to this college. They went to worked at that company, you know. And much to my own surprise, I became what was called a fast burner. And I really excelled. As much as it would kill me to, take orders and do all those things, which I wasn't used to, there was a lot about that culture that I did quite well in. I got promoted fast, And, you know, I ended up staying on active duty for about 4 or 5 years. Then I came back into the reserves and I got married young, and we had a baby. So now I needed more income. So I ended up applying to this job in corporate America and in a technical role, which I had no business being in because I had no academic background in that whatsoever, no practical IT experience at all. I kind of did a Hail Mary and applied, and I was interviewed, and somehow I got the job. At the same time, I started caring a lot about politics. Now, this is in my mid-20s. Because I was looking at politics as a way to affect social change, right? And specifically find opportunities to keep young people from falling through the cracks. I didn't know how else to try to make a difference. You know, this was in the mid-90s. You know, I started knocking on some doors to see if I could get involved with some political campaigns, and nobody would really see me because I didn't know anybody. I didn't have any connections. So there was this thing, I don't know if you've heard of it, Srini, it's called the World Wide Web. You ever heard of that?
Yeah.
So there's this whole www.whatever.com thing happening. It was a couple years old. One thing I didn't tell you was that in my teenage years, I did a fair amount of graffiti, some street art, and you know, I was a cartoonist. I made comics and all kinds of stuff. So I thought, well, hey, you know what would be cool is what if I could make a website for somebody that's running for office, but not ask their permission to do it. Okay, so I'll make a website, which you know came easily to me. Self-taught web designer. I'll stand up a website. I'll put all kinds of content onto it. And back then it was hard to make content. You know,
I remember.
Yeah. Right. You're doing a lot of scanning of newspaper articles and magazine articles, right? And your content is like, you know, GIF files and JPEGs. Yeah. But then I'll knock on the campaign headquarters door, introduce myself and say, hey, you know, I'm Shane. I've made this website for your candidate. Do you want it? And in 1995, 96, they would inevitably say, well, that's pretty neat, but you know, we don't know anything about that. And that sounds expensive. So no thanks. And I said, no, you don't understand. I'm giving you this website. You can have it. I just want to maintain the site and be a part of the campaign. And now all of a sudden, you know, a whole different tune, right? Now, oh, come on in, you know, so all of a sudden, I found myself in these political circles where I was the youngest guy in the room by 20 years at least. And what would happen is, you know, what started as just doing some web design and being a webmaster turned into creating content too, which turned into speech writing, which turned into, you know, before I knew it, I was in my late 20s and I was doing campaign management, communications director stuff. And I worked on a presidential primary, a congressional campaign, state campaigns. It was really cool. All while having, you know, a baby, still in the reserves. I still have a foot in corporate America, and I'm doing this till, you know, 2 a.m. every day. So that was happening. And then enter 9/11. Okay. And after 9/11, my reserve unit got activated. So I was part of one of the biggest Air Force reserve wings in the world. So on Christmas Eve, after 9/11, I got put on active duty for about 14 months. Okay. And so I went, you know, I checked out of my corporate job. I by law, I had to resign from any political associations. You can't be on active duty and also work in a political partisan capacity. So now I'm done with corporate, I'm done with politics, and I'm wearing a uniform every day. Well, long story short, Srini, and I appreciate your patience on this. I'm a few months into this active duty role, and I'm at a retirement party for this guy that's retiring in the Air Force. And he said, hey, Shane, have you ever heard of the White House Communication Agency? I said, no, I have no idea what that is. He says, oh, you know, it's this, you know, they handle all of the communications for the president, the vice president, the first lady, you know, everything. They do all the communications work. He's like, you should check them out with your background. You might be great there. I'm like, okay, thanks, whatever. So I didn't really think about it until a couple months later. So a couple months later, I'm on lunch, I'm at the base, and I pull up my Yahoo browser, right? Maybe it was Yahoo. I'm not even sure. It might have been Netscape at the time.
Yeah.
And I looked up the White House Communication Agency, and I was a little intrigued by it. And what was happening at that time was folks from my unit were being sent all over the place. You know, at that time, in support of things that were happening in Afghanistan. So either people were going overseas or they were going somewhere else domestically to support those efforts. There was a lot of uncertainty. So I made an inquiry and I said, listen, you know, it was a total cold call on an email. And I introduced myself and I said, you know, here's a little bit about me. Here's my background. I'm on active duty. I'm intrigued by this office. I'm just curious if there's any way that I can contribute to what's going on, but through the White House instead of at the local base that I was at. It was a total shot in the dark. You know, I had no business writing that email and I had no business of ever expecting anyone to respond. So about a week later, I got an email saying, you know, don't call us, we'll call you. Thanks for your interest, right? And then a week after that, I'm in a big blanket fort with my two little kids. It's like 9 o'clock at night and the phone rings. And it's the White House. And I'm like, I couldn't believe it. I'm like, am I getting crank called here? Like, what's going on? And long story short, they needed a web designer and somebody that could do other things in a communications role. So between my web background and, you know, the little bit of political work that I did, they thought that I was a good fit. Hmm. So, you know, 2 weeks later, I was off to the White House. And, you know, I couldn't believe it. You know, the first time I walked through, you know, the gate by the West Wing, you know, showed my credentials and I'm actually on the inside of the gate and I'm looking back, you know, at pedestrians. I had to pinch myself every day that I was there. It was the most unbelievable opportunity, you know, the people I met, it was the people and the leadership that I was most impressed by. It was just absolutely amazing. Every day I pinched myself and every day I couldn't believe they would let somebody like me through the doors and do the things that I did. I was creating apps for them. I redesigned their whole intranet site and then I volunteered to do everything. I was away from my family the whole time I was there. So I'm like, listen, you know, throw work at me, bring it on. It was absolutely fantastic. Greatest experience.
Wow. That raises so many questions. I mean, when you mentioned military and White House, obviously, you know, I had a very clear intent in mind as to why I wanted to have you talk about this. You know, like I've been fortunate enough to have probably three or four conversations here on the podcast with people who've been in the military. I got to go and give a talk to a bunch of former Joint Special Operations guys, to one of our listeners who runs a nonprofit in Montana where he trains retired Special Forces guys how to transition into civilian careers. And you have this very unusual blend of both the military background and the sort of political and communication background. So what I wonder is, what do you think that people like me, who have had no direct experience with the military, but only experience it through what I see in the media, through what I see in the news, misunderstand about the military? Because I can tell you, like, I think the thing that we, you know, for those of us who've never spent any time there, all we think is, why are you spending all our taxpayer money policing the world and letting citizens at home suffer? That's like our first instinct. But I think that that's not entirely fair, because that's my own bias as somebody who's never been in your role. I don't have the context that you do. What do you think people like me misunderstand about this?
Yeah, that's such a good point, you know, and it's funny because whether I was in, you know, the military active duty or the reserves or corporate America or wherever, I never introduced myself as a senior master sergeant in the Air Force. And nor have I ever introduced myself as a talent, you know, management director in corporate America. You know, I'm always Shane. And if anything, if I meet somebody for the first time, I introduce myself as a writer first, right? And so the reason why I say that is I never really, I made a point to never kind of let any one thing, quote, own me, right? Like I'm not, because every institution is wildly imperfect, right? Whether it's the military or corporate America or nonprofits, I mean, they're wildly imperfect. When I think about, you know, my experience in the military, combined 25 years of active duty and reserves, I think a few things come to mind. First, every mission that the military goes on is sanctioned by civilian elected officials. That is, like, the military doesn't come up with the missions. They need to prepare for the missions. They need to train for missions. They have to be ready for the missions. But the military brass, the leadership, they don't sit in a room and say, okay, where's the next war? You know, where's the next war going to be? Or where's the next humanitarian relief going to happen? Right? It's civilian elected officials. It's Congress, right? So it's Congress and the president that chooses to use the military in the way that they see fit, right? Sometimes they're, you know, sometimes they're solving, you know, military problems, and sometimes they're solving diplomatic problems. And sometimes it's not always the right fit and it's not the right choice. But I think it's important to remind people, and I'm probably going to get into, and I'm sure a lot of people will have an opinion about this, but at the end of the day, I actually wrote an article and it was on NPR several years ago about this topic. At the end of the day, if we don't like what the military is doing, we have to look to our elected officials. We have to look to Congress and the president. They're the ones that fund them. They're the ones that give the orders. You know, the military executes the orders by civilian leaders.
Yeah. You know? Let's talk about the communications piece briefly. You know, I mean, of all the roles, obviously, that is probably one of the most interesting ones you could have, given the current context of what we're dealing with. As somebody who has been in your position, when you watch what happens in our press briefings right now, when you watch the way this White House functions, what is your view on all of this? Because, you know, you said this was the kind of place where you wondered, you know, how they could let somebody like you through the gates. Now it's become the kind of place where you probably would say, you know what, thanks, I'll stay outside of the gates, at least in my opinion. You know, and again, look, I mean, it's no secret that I'm liberal. I swing left. Like, I've not, you know, been apologetic about that. But I also think it's important that we try to find common ground. And I feel like we're getting further and further away from that. Between, you know, the fact that we have media that is very divisive, multiple versions of the facts. You know, we did I was just listening to Cal Fussman, the interview that we did with him that we aired on our Best of Friday. He said, you know, back in the 60s, he said you had one source of truth and it was Walter Cronkite. And now you have like 700. But you worked in the communications department of all things. And, you know, when you see a daily press briefing and what, like four press secretaries, you know, like what do you make of all of this, given your past and your background? Is it, you know, like, is it the chaos that we all perceive it to be?
Well, I will say, you know, so first of all, I was there in 2002. So a little time has clicked by. But fundamentally, it's probably a very, very similar situation. And we had the internet, we had cell phones, we had all those things. Everything was, you know, in place. I remember that time, now this was post 9/11, so things were a little crazy, but I remember being so impressed with how these teams could keep up with the president and the vice president and the first lady. I was just blown away by the dedication and the commitment to mission. These were, you know, this team was apolitical. They transcended presidents. They weren't political appointees. I wasn't a political appointee, right? I was the help. And I just remember the incredible pressure on the teams, especially young people. And I couldn't believe how people could rise to the challenge, meet the challenge. I'll never forget when I'm a history buff, and one of the first questions that I had for people when I was there was, you know, who do you like better, you know, George Bush Jr. or Bill Clinton? I was always curious, like, because most of the people that were there had worked for both presidents and beyond, right? So I was just curious. I was a big West Wing fan at the time, you know, and I was just curious. And it's funny, they always had two answers. Everybody had two answers. They say, well, you know, most people said that they liked Bill Clinton better than George Bush, but they'd rather work for George Bush. Wow. I thought that was interesting. And I'd be like, well, I don't understand. If you like Bill Clinton better, why wouldn't you want to work for Bill Clinton? And inevitably, the answer would be, well, George Bush, you know, notwithstanding with George, notwithstanding some national emergency, some horrific thing that was going on, it was lights out after a certain amount of time, right? I mean, he would leave the West Wing and go back to the residence, you know, at whatever time it was, 6 o'clock at night or whatever. No news after six, whatever the time was. And so the people that were working for him could plan their lives around that.
Right.
Okay, right? They could get their kid to softball practice. They could, you know, they can meet commitments. They could be on the school committee. They can, you know, because they could plan. They knew that for the most part, their day would start at this time and it would end at that time, notwithstanding some, you know, something crazy. But with Bill Clinton, you know, he was very likable, super charismatic and all of those things, but he never shut it off, right? The day would never end, right? So I never forget the first time I was in the West Wing and somebody was talking to me and they said, you did not want to be in the West Wing at 8 o'clock at night because Bill Clinton could walk by your desk and it didn't matter who you were, didn't matter what role you played. There was a sporting chance that he would sit down next to your desk and you'd end up in a 3-hour conversation. You know, and it would, you'd go into these philosophical rants and they appreciated that. They liked it. So, you know, it was just hard to work around that. That's all.
Yeah.
You know, where with George Bush, it was a little more of a linear type of thing, you know, on off, we're working or we're not working. Where with Clinton, you know, he was really never not working. So I think about the chaos of that the Clinton White House must have been like, and I think about today, you know, it must pale in comparison. You know, I mean, I don't know anybody there anymore. It's been, you know, a long, long time, but I have to imagine the teams that are supporting this administration, they're working harder than ever to keep up.
Yeah.
You know?
Wow. So, you know, I guess the final piece of this is like, you know, you look at that part of it, what do you make of the media landscape, you know, as somebody who worked in communications? I mean, I guess this is a question I posed to Cal Fussman. What do you think is the responsibility of people in the media? I mean, I'm a media creator and obviously I'm having this conversation through the lens of my bias towards the left. Like I'm going to say that.
Yeah.
There's no question. I just the way I phrase the question makes it very obvious, but I know that I have listeners who don't think the same thing I do. I mean, I know for a fact because I was on the Glenn Beck show and that's where we got a lot of listeners. Right. So I guess, you know, like to me, I wonder what is the responsibility of media in today's society as somebody who has worked in your role?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. Boy, I mean, we could talk a lot just about that topic, but I don't know. For me, when I think about communications, I think one of the, in today's world, I mean, when you think about the world that we're living in today, it's unprecedented, right? You can't look back in history at any point in history and go, oh, you know, it's kind of like that time. You know, it's there's no time. And any time in the past that was similar, it really pales in comparison when you think about the exponential rate of change that's happening in front of us and the rate of that change and the avalanche of information and the feeding of the machine, right? The 24/7 and the Twitterverse and like it's this, you know, it's really when you take a step back, it's so challenging for people to really dig in and understand anything. You know, our attention spans are shorter. We're multitasking. We have, you know, dubious, you know, sources of information. I think it's incredibly challenging. You know, I always kid around. No point in history have we had more access to more information at once. And at no point in history have we been less able to communicate with each other, you know, effectively. You know what I mean? Because there's a difference between sending a quick text and effectively communicating or having a conversation for 15 minutes and not looking at your phone. So I think one of the things that we could do better is to exercise some sort of patience, either when we're writing the content and not being so quick to develop things so quickly, but also, you know, face it, at the end of the day, most everything we're talking about in the media is about human beings, and human beings are very nuanced. Yeah, there are really good people and really bad people. But for the most part, people are very nuanced, and to understand those nuances and those different dimensions requires a level of patience, which is very challenging in today's world. We don't get rewarded for doing things slow. We don't get rewarded for doing things 20% longer than the person next to us, right? But I think that's the opportunity that's in front of us is really taking a breath, having the patience when we're talking about other people and paying attention, you know, to those nuances, because not everybody is one dimensional as much as we like to make people out to be. I think doing that as a content creator or somebody in the media is probably more difficult than ever, but I think it's a worthwhile thing to try.
So let's bring this full circle and talk about how it connects to Rocket Crew. First, for the people who don't know what Rocket Crew is, tell them what it is. But I think to me, as I was saying when we started this conversation, the thing that struck me most was the role that music played in all of this. And as somebody who has had a lifelong love affair with music, as somebody whose dad handed him the tape of Thriller and I played it until it stopped working, I think that, you know, looking at this soundtrack that you put together that kind of was woven in the book, just kind of, that spoke to me on so many levels. So like, how did that all come about?
So how did Rocket Crew come about?
I mean, what is a Rocket Crew and how is it that music played this pivotal role in your friendships?
Yeah, so Rocket Crew is about four teenagers, they're best friends. It takes place in the summer of 1984. They're 14 and 15 years old, and they're living in Western Massachusetts. So about a good hour and a half plus from New York City. And they accidentally discover this brand new sound called rap music. Right, which falls under the umbrella of hip hop. Okay, they discover it, and for a variety of reasons, it just resonates with them. They felt kind of like it was the new punk rock of the early 80s. Bands like artists like Grandmaster Flash and Curtis Blow, and like they were singing songs, they were rapping songs about, you know, the world around them and you know, themes like never giving up and always have hope. And yeah, they were talking about the inner city, but for a variety of reasons, it just resonated with these kids. And that's great. So practically overnight, these four kids, they turn into wannabe B-boys. And the problem is the town is kind of stuck in the past and they're not ready for this at all. So they stick out like sore thumbs. And some of the older kids in the town really go out of their way to make their life difficult. It becomes a very confrontational thing with the members of the Rocket Crew, these four kids, and these older kids in town. These older kids weren't just driving by, yelling out the window at them as they walk down the street with their boombox and their Michael Jackson red leather jacket on. They became very, very confrontational. So, you know, this book isn't about hip hop, but it's about you know, that is the backdrop. What the book is about is how difficult it is to find your identity as a young person or even as an older person, and how difficult it is to, you know, dare to be different, right? To, you know, when the world around you wants you to conform, when the world around you rewards you for doing exactly what you're supposed to be doing. You know, these four kids, you know, they had it tough. And the more that the town pushed back on them, the more galvanized they became, the more more attitude they had. So it's this story about the unbelievable power of those friendships that you had when you were young and how those friendships can get you through, you know, the worst adversity. And also, you know, how challenging it is for people to stand up and be different, especially in the early 80s. I mean, hip hop was not, it was not on the radio. It wasn't even on the radio in major metropolitan areas and urban districts. You know, you really had to go out of your way to find this music. So for these kids, it, you know, hip hop was something that made them stand out. It made them look different, sound different, be different. You know, they embraced it with everything that they had. And the music, you know, the original Rocket Crew manuscript, when I submitted it, had a, at the beginning of each chapter, had lyrics to a different song. But then the publisher wasn't happy with that. So I had ended up having to pull that from it. But yeah, the music really mattered. I mean, at that time, what a lot of people don't realize with hip hop is, you know, old school hip hop that really came, you know, into its own in the mid to late 70s through the early 80s was a very, very different type of sound than it is today. And it was a very different type of sound than it was in the 90s even. It was very experimental. They were not looking back. They were looking forward. You know, stylistically, it was very different. The, you know, what they rapped about was very different. Yeah, you had your party songs, but, you know, there was a lot of incredibly inspirational music coming out. You know, you think about Grandmaster Flash and The Message. You think about, you know, Curtis Blow, you know, lyrics like, you know, life's too short, we're all going to die, so go for the gusto, reach for the sky, you know, or, you know, Run DMC, you know, it's like that, you know, or, you know, they're talking about going to school, staying in school, that kind of thing. So, you know, the story is technically it's a novel and it's fiction. But it's really based on my best friends and my experiences when I was 14 and a half years old. So I've had the story in the back of my head for a very, very long time. You know, I was talking to somebody recently. I never shared my background with people in corporate America or the military until probably less than 10 years ago. You know, and so I had the story, I knew the characters, I knew the scenarios, I knew how it started, I kind of knew how it ended. And although I was writing books and I was doing, you know, screenplays, and I never really thought about creating one story for the Rocket Crew. And mostly because I kind of detached myself from that world for decades. You know, when by the time I got into the military and I, you know, and then politics and corporate America in the 90s, I never really looked back at that world. It was always part of me. Yeah. You know, being that B-boy, the breakdancer, it was always part of me, but I never really showed it for a variety of reasons, especially in corporate America at that time. And then, you know, fast forward till 2010 and enter this crazy thing called Facebook. And I get a friend request, and it's from my good buddy, Gene. And Gene was part of the Rocket Crew. And I hadn't seen Gene since 1987, 88. Because what happened in real life is things started getting very challenging. And I had to make a decision. In 1987, 1988, as a 17-year-old, I had to choose one way or another way. And it's kind of a long story, but what happened was I disassociated myself with that whole world and with the Rocket Crew. And they went one way and I went another. And I hadn't seen him, heard from anybody since then, and this is 2010. So he contacts me through Facebook. We end up getting together, and I was thrilled. And I went out and we had dinner, and he got me up to speed on what happened with him and what happened with the other members of the Rocket Crew. And I kind of explained where I was coming from at the time. And, you know, we laughed, and I'm about to leave, Srini. And he says, "Oh man," he says, "you can't go yet." And I'm like, "Well, why?" He's like, "Hold on one second." So he leaves the room and he comes back and he's holding this cassette tape. And on the tape, it says 20-year tape, 1986. Don't listen until 2006. And this is in 2010. And I'm like, "I can't believe you have that." So what happened was, is a friend of ours had died. And the night after he died, when we were kids, we made a 20-year tape. And we sat around a boombox in my friend's bedroom. And we talked about our friend. And we talked about what life was like in 1986. And then we thought about what life would be like in the next 20 years. Who would marry Madonna first? You know, and then we made a pact to get together in 2006. No matter what we were doing, we were going to all get together and listen to the tape. We made copies for everyone. We taped them up, and you know, the rest is history. Well, of course, that never happened in 2006, but we listened to it that night. So it's like 2 a.m. I'm still at his house, and we're listening to this 120-minute tape, and we're listening to these voices, you know, from so long ago, filled with hope and, you know, aspirational dreams, and, you know, just, you know, listening to these innocent young voices. And, you know, we laughed and cried and laughed and cried and probably cried a little more than laughed. And then he handed me the tape. Because what had happened with him was, you know, he had a pretty rough life. You know, he had a lot of challenges in his adult life. And, you know, he had some really, really tough situations he had to get himself out of. But he was on his way back. He struggled for a long, long, long time. But when I was having dinner with him that night, you know, he was sober and he was excited about the future. And then we listened to that tape and he gave it to me. And, you know, since 2010, I thought, you know, maybe the Rocket Crew is worth telling people about. Maybe those kids had something unique. Maybe there was, you know, something that the world's going to benefit from by listening to this story. So long story short, I started writing the Rocket Crew in like 2017. It started as some short stories and then turned into a couple short indie screenplays. And then I got serious about it in 2019, and, you know, it was published. The paperback came out in February of this year, and the audiobook just came out a couple months ago.
Amazing. Well, I think that makes a perfect setup for my final question, which I know you've heard me ask. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
I knew you were going to ask me that. What makes somebody, let's see, that's such a, you know, when you ask me that, I think about all of your other terrific guests and their answers. And I'm thinking, boy, you know, am I going to say something that somebody else has said? When I think of somebody who's creative, I think of somebody who will be creative no matter what the circumstances are. Okay, whether you're in the military or you're in corporate America or you're in a rock band, you know, or a punk band or whatever, I think a truly authentically creative person is someone who will find ways to be creative no matter what is happening in their life. You know, it's like when I'm talking to people, you know, and they say, "Well, Shane, you know, I want to write a book but I don't know what, you know, I know I can write a book, I'm an author or whatever, but I've never written a novel. I don't know what to write about. You know, what do you think I should do? And I said, you know, one of the things I always say is, you know, if you could climb to the top of the Empire State Building, right, and had the biggest badass microphone and speaker system going, and you had the attention of every New Yorker for an hour, and you could tell them a story, you have one shot, what would it be? Don't think too long. Just what would the story be? What would you shout down from the top of the Empire State Building down to millions of New Yorkers who gave you their undivided attention for an hour? And whatever it is that comes to mind, that's the thing you should be writing about, because you aren't going to struggle with that. Whatever that thing is probably burning a hole in your soul. So the thing that you should be writing about is the thing that's burning a hole in your soul. It's the thing that you dream about. It's the thing that you feel guilty about not doing at the end of a long day, right? So I think truly creative people are those people that have a handful of those kinds of things in their gut, in their soul. You know, they have a handful of projects, books, things that they have to get out into the universe no matter what. And no matter what their circumstances are, no matter how busy their day is, you know, they're going to find a way to get it out into the universe. So I for me, when I think about, you know, the answer to your question is, you know, that's what comes to mind. It's someone that will always find a way to get their creativity out into the universe.
Amazing. This has been absolutely brilliant, as I expected it would be. And I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us and share your story, your wisdom, and your insights with us. Where can people find out more about you, your book, and everything else that you're up to?
Yeah, so I'm on Twitter at Shane Robitaille, ShaneRobitaille. I used to be on Facebook, but that's kind of a digital wasteland for creativity. So I put most of the stuff out on Twitter. You can follow me on Twitter. And I want to thank you again, because I'm still pinching myself that I'm actually talking to you. It's been such a thrill, because like I said, before you hit record, you know, you've been the voice in my headphones at the gym and doing laundry and picking up the kids and, you know, for probably 4 or 5 years anyway. So, it's really a thrill, to chat with you.
Likewise. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.